I'm Rob McRae, and the expression is called Wunderkammer, Wunderkammer being German for Cabinet of Wonders, and the work is basically using taxidermy, and the idea behind using taxidermy is that, my belief is that if you want to talk about conservation and animal-human relations and issues relating to climate change and those big issues, then the most effective way to do it is to do it authentically and show people the real thing, as opposed to show them something in plaster or marble or steel or even faux fur. So the idea is that by giving people the real thing, they have a real emotion towards it. Maybe they hate it, maybe they love it. But they're very, very seldom ambivalent, and in that they tend to engage with the work, I think.
But it certainly does have an incredible impact when you walk into this space and you see these things here. Just on the taxidermy then, how does that part of it work? Do you do that work yourself, or tell us about that?
It's an interesting. It's not really cost effective for me to do a lot of the work myself. I tend to have the work done. Where I locate the skin. So the most important thing is that the skin is actually sourced really authentically and really, ethically. So I need to know where the skin's come from, how it's been come by. If it's been hunted as long as I haven't hunted it, I can't stop people from hunting, but I can at least use the skin, that part of the animal that's been hunted and tell its story with its own, in a sense, with its own reconstruction. So the zebra behind me, it's a virtual zebra, and I bought that on eBay. And the animal, being a whole animal, was in fact part of a series of mounts that were owned by a big game hunter, an American big game hunter. And I think during the financial crash, he went bust, and so he sold his collection. And this piece of work ended up in Montana, I think it was, and on eBay. And so I had it shipped to Australia. And the provenance of this particular piece is that he hunted it, I did a little bit of research into virtual zebras, and what's particularly interesting about them, apart from the fact they're big stripy ponies, is they're hardly vicious. But the one thing that we do know about them is they're actually incredibly inquisitive. So if you shoot at a herd of zebra, if you're a really bad shot, you're just really basically best just to wait where you are, because they'll all go for a bit of a run. Then they'll all come back to find out what the fuss was about. So you've got a pretty good chance of shooting them for the second time. So in there lays all sorts of questions about, the heroic nature of big game hunting and what on earth is a grown man running around with a gun shooting an oversized pony in the first place for, and how does that make him feel more masculine, and how does that then again, in turn feed into notions of stewardship. And
I guess there is quite a strong statement with this work, though. On the other side, you've got some guns and Christian hunters, and that, of course, raises all sorts of other questions. I'm just curious with this, with having acquired the zebra, though, does the person you bought it from, do they know what you've done with it?
Probably not. No, I wouldn't imagine. No. No, and really it doesn't matter, does it? I mean, I'm not going to change that person's opinion of hunting, that's irrelevant.
So look, in that case, the animal in this particular work is pretty much as it is, yeah. But in many of your other works, you've sort of, I guess, either modified them, put them in unusual poses, placed them with things which don't match. So
yeah. The lion on the bed, for example, he's a 10-year-old male lion, this works very much about the domestication of the wild. And, we talk about wilderness, we talk about the wild, but it doesn't really exist anymore. Everything's finite, everything is cut by roads and rail and fences. And so the freedom of movement for wildlife, whether it be, bison in America, or whether it be, large carnivores in Africa, is limited and controlled by man's ever encroachment on their environment. So this piece of work is very much about the lion lying on the bed is very much about the subduing of the wild. The bed becomes its territory, if you like. As you can see, there's a chain and a collar there. He's not bolted to it. It's there. He can be attached to it, but he's free to move. But he's sort of rolling there, domesticated, like your cat might be. And the pose was taken from my cat when I had this piece of work made for me in South Africa. You know, the taxidermist said, "What?" You know, because large carnivores are always posed in a certain way. You know, they're always posed to look very vicious and very aggressive, and therefore to substantiate and to reinforce the whole idea of hunting, and so that the man has dominion over the beast, and man has, you know, ultimate power over the natural world. So to actually reduce this, you know, king of the jungle, this high-end carnivore, to a playful cat is kind of at very much at odds with the way the animal has traditionally been expressed.
Some of the pairings are very interesting, though. There's I notice over here we've got a fox looking after some ducklings, and over here a lioness with some lambs.
I guess that these come back to those notions of the natural world. And yes, there are some very strange paternal sort of situations that happen between species or interspecies. And however, there's absolutely no way you could put a group of ducklings with a fox without them being torn to pieces. You know, it's unlikely that a group of lamb would cohabitate, least of all be nurtured by a lion. However, there are biblical passages which would suggest that the lion lay down with the lambs, or the lamb day long, or the lion lay down with the wolves, or whatever. And, you know, I guess these are all about our own discomfort with nature and its ungodliness, and, you know, and its viciousness. And we like to imagine that somehow animals behave with the same sort of morality and value systems that humans do. Clearly they don't, but we would like to believe that. And we use those things in many ways to hide behind, and to, you know. So these are kind of like exposing some of those foibles and just saying, hey, this just doesn't happen. This is silly, you know. But nonetheless, it's worthy of thought and thinking about, why is that wrong? Why doesn't that happen? Why could that happen?
How do works begin for you? You know, did you sort of say to yourself, okay, I want to you know, get hold of these particular animals, oh, I want to put them in this position, or do you sort of acquire things and then think, well, yeah, that sort of works with that, or if I chop a head off of this and put a mirror there, that happens, you know?
I guess a lot of it's what-if-ing, you know. For instance, with the work Serengeti, you know, there's the springbok. I was reading about how springbok were actually valued for their heads, because they make pretty little, you know, mounts for their heads, and they're very sellable and what have you. I got thinking about what happened to the bodies. You know, if they're whipping their heads off, what happens to the rest of them? So I got onto my taxidermist in South Africa, and I said, you know, do you work with springboks? He said, yes. I said, what do you do with the bodies? And he said, oh, what do you mean? And I said, well, can you do me up? Can you mount the bodies? I know you're taking the heads. Can you mount the bodies for me? He said, what would you want those for? Anyway, so hence the whole scene, which is kind of based on a scene at the American Natural History Museum in New York, which have these wonderful big tableaus, you know, which is still there from the 1920s. And I thought, how extraordinary would it be to actually create something like that, but with all the heads removed, so that, you know, the whole work is quite sort of challenging. And then, of course, the natural inclination of humans is to, or the viewer is to go and have a look and see what's down the neck, you know, what's there. And there's a mirror, actually, it's been placed there. And, of course, the idea is that the mirror becomes quite an accusing sort of vehicle. So you see yourself in that, and you kind of ask yourself, well, am I complicit in their demise somehow?
Look at it, yeah, it is. You're right. It's an exhibition that's very engaging, but unsettling, I can imagine, as well for some people. But, you know, you're right. I imagine there must be very few people that see your work and that walk away without feeling something about it. Yeah. Which is what you want as an artist, surely. That's good, yeah.
I think that's probably the greatest accolade an artist can have, is, you know, you make somebody cry, or you make somebody think, or you make somebody angry, but you make people feel something. You know, they don't just whip round and leave and go, oh, yeah, rightio, what was I buying for, you know, lunch, or what did I have to pick up from Woolies or something, you know what I mean? It takes us on a wee journey and asks us a lot of questions, and hopefully you know, asks us to think about how complicit we are in the whole process. Yeah.